Welcome back to the ACRL Files. Our listeners know that the American College of Real Estate Lawyers is a national organization of 1,000 distinguished practitioners fostering the exchange of the most sophisticated ideas and experiences in the development, financing, and investment in real estate. We continue our series of podcasts with leading individuals in the industry who have built the companies that have shaped the commercial real estate world to share reflections on their careers and predictions for the future. Today, I'm so pleased to welcome Mary Ann Tighe, CEO of the New York Region for CBRE, who, by the way, is a gold-level sponsor of the college. During her remarkable career of more than four decades in commercial real estate, Mary Ann has been at the forefront of the transformation of the New York City skyline, for which I look forward to hearing much about today. Mary Ann, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm honored.
Thank you. So before we chat about your incredible career back at ESG and CBRE, let's just roll back a little bit and start from the beginning and tell us a little bit about, you know, where you grew up, what, you know, what went to college, and how you got into real estate.
So to try and take a long story and put it in a nutshell, I am a child of the South Bronx. My parents were working class people. My mother was the secretary at the Catholic rectory where the priest lived as I was growing up. And my dad worked as a warehouse manager in Manhattan. And I was the first in my family to go to college.
Great.
And I certainly had absolutely no knowledge of commercial real estate. In fact, when Ed Gordon was reluctant to hire me back in the day, he used as his reason that I didn't come from a business family, that nobody talked about business over the dinner table, which was the, by the way, the exact opposite of Ed's own environment, where his mom and dad were partners in a notion, what they called a notions business. In any event, I had, however, a series of very lucky breaks. When I was 27, I went to work in the Carter Mondale administration in the White House. 2 years later, I became a chief operating officer of the National Endowment for the Arts, which is a federal agency. I overlapped both the Carter Mondale and the Reagan administration. And then I moved to New York City to start what is the A&E Channel. And it was the life that I was leading at the A&E Channel, which was super interesting work. I had a real career path if I wanted to stay in that world, although it would have required me, I think, to move to LA. And the problem was I had a husband who was training to be a surgeon, and I had a young son, and I was traveling way too much. And one day on a trip to Italy to buy television product from the Italian network RAI, R-A-I, I ended up meeting a New York commercial real estate broker, retired, and we shared, he was on the same flight home as I was, and he told me the story of his career, and I thought, I can do that. I was 36 years old. And
wow.
He introduced me to three different players, one of which was Harry Helmsley, who never returned my call, and ultimately led to me being hired by the Edward S. Gordon Company. And that was the beginning of my career.
Wow, that's just an amazing, I mean, lots of people that I've run across in the industry came out of sales jobs. Right.
Yes.
I mean, Lois Zambo, you know, Audrey Kramer down here, right, who were wildly successful brokers. Right. I mean, Lois was hired to be Julian's, I think, assistant down here at Studley back when it was Julian J. Studley. But the transition from coming out of the art world, I know you were an art historian in college, right?
And right. I am. I published a history. I was co-author of a history of American art and actually wrote a monograph on a single artist as well. So I was a serious art historian.
So I'm sure when you got your break and, you know, pivoted on your own accord into real estate, there were lots and lots of challenges being a young woman in the New York real estate market. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I think that it was such a ferocious boys club. And I often think about why that didn't, and I should tell you this, I had the great blessing of having, and the reason why I chose to go to Edward S. Gordon is because it was the only firm that had a successful woman broker. Nobody else, there were successful property women property managers in the other firms, No one had a successful woman broker. And Carol Nelson was an executive vice president of Ed's company. And ultimately, she became my mentor and then my partner, or I became her partner more accurately. I think that choosing it on that basis was very wise. So what I would say to you is a couple of things about why it worked for me. The first is that I grew up in a household of working class men. My father was one of four brothers, and my mother, as I was growing up, worked nights. She was a cashier at a department store called Alexander's. My dad would take me, at that point, for 6 years, I was his only child. He would take me to events that were all men. There's a picture of me at I don't know what age, under the age of two, sitting on a bar, in a bar called the Algo Bar, with his softball team all around me. And there I am in a dress with a big bow in my hair. And I always think that at some level, if you feel like you are the darling of your father, if you're a woman who feels like you are the darling of your father's life, any man who doesn't like you, you actually think it's his problem, not yours. I mean, there was always a comfort for me in that. Second thing is, by the time you've worked in the White House and testified before Congress, and all of that happened before I entered real estate, it's really hard to intimidate. The then senator from Illinois, Sid Yates, was the chairman of the committee. We testified. We defended our budget before each year. I did that four times. And Sidney Yates was a brilliant man, and you really had to be a top of your game. Who was going to scare me? Think about what that felt like for a young person. So I had that comfort. And then I think I cannot underestimate the fact that Carol Nelson took the body blows for me. So she went ahead. I always say she mowed the path. I walked down the path. So that was the tough part. The wonderful part was that Ed had an almost unstructured environment. It was a kind of entrepreneurial free-for-all. And it had its own energy. I felt when I was there, even though I came to learn later how narrow the scope of the firm actually was, I came to feel like I was at the center of New York real estate. And that if I listened to what was going on around me, I could learn so much. And I also always felt that if I produced, my gender was not at issue at all. And in truth, every single year I was eligible for a promotion, I got it. So Ed promoted you by giving you, and I think about, he had cards made up with your new title on it, and he would ask you to come and see him, or he'd come and see you, and he'd hand you your box of new cards. And that's how you knew you were moving along. And I would tell you that until I got to the executive vice president level, I didn't feel any pushback at all gender related. Now, my mentor, Carol, never got beyond EVP. They would not promote her beyond that. And I'll tell you the story of my becoming vice chairman of the firm. We had a manager, a lovely man named Joe Harbert. And I asked him out. I was executive vice president now, and I was on the cusp of making what would be my own personal first signature deal. It's about 10 years after I was in the business, which was the Condé Nast deal.
In Times Square.
And I that deal was sort of in the process of happening. I felt I was poised to do this, and I felt like I had all the street cred to be a vice chairman. So I was thinking about this the other day. I invited Joe to lunch, and we went to lunch, and whatever the place we went, by the way, it had paper napkins. I always think about this because at the lunch, he drew as you would a football, thing, X's and O's, when you're showing the opposing teams. And he essentially was showing me who among my colleagues would oppose my promotion. And the net result of the X's and O's and the arrows, and again, I actually still have this napkin. I dated it. It was 1997. I dated it. And I have it in my album here in the country. And the bottom line was, you won't get this promotion. And then in my album, on the opposite page, I have the press release a year later announcing my being appointed to vice chairman. And I always think about those two pieces of paper as sort of illustrating for me the mindset you had to have, which was, do not allow other people to define. What it told me was, nobody in the firm was going to be a champion of my doing it. So it had to appear to Ed Gordon, who, by the way, was the only one to decide, so inevitable from whatever was happening outside the firm. And it put me on a path that ultimately led to me, for example, becoming chairman of the real estate board in 2010. I mean, the things I set in place in 97 so that I could become vice chairman were things that ultimately opened my career even wider. But it was an important day for me to realize, okay, I can't count on any of this. And sadly, Carol, who was a great broker, never was able to, but she retired, I think, in 99, if I'm not mistaken. So we were at a different stage in our careers too.
So there's so many good lessons in there about picking a role model when you went to ESG, right? Finding the right mentors. And of course, as you said, being focused on your path and being persistent in what you're doing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think those are all key life lessons, business traits. I don't think they're peculiar to real estate, that's for sure.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about New York and the transformation that you've played such an important role in. You mentioned, I mean, I grew up outside New York, so I consider myself almost a New Yorker, right? So I remember Times Square when it was not too much. It was safe, sort of, kind of, most of the time to walk through when I was a kid, but it wasn't very nice, right? And now it is what it is. One of the two or three, right, centers of the world inside New York City. But you were there to see it transform, and you not only there, you played a major role in that. So talk a little bit about, you know, what your observations of that. And you've seen it obviously downtown, both before 9/11, after 9/11, Hudson Yards. You've seen all these places that really, in part, didn't exist, right, and are now major centers of commercial real estate in the most important city in the world, of course. So how has that happened? How did you get involved, and what do you see happening there going forward?
You know, in hindsight, you have to say to yourself, in the center of one of the great global cities, on mass transit hubs, as both downtown, as both the Trade Center and Times Square are, how could anyone have written off? I mean, it seems, again, in hindsight, it seems so obvious. But what really was the trigger for me with Times Square, and I do believe that I played a material role in this, because I always say a tenant is the solution to almost any real estate, any commercial real estate problem. Mm-hmm. You can throw all the money in the world at it, et cetera. What you need is the occupant who will energize and obviously produce the cash flow that make it all viable, and the credit to make it all viable. But anyway, when I moved back to New York after leaving the Washington World and the National Endowment for the Arts, I was, as you can imagine, very knowledgeable about grant making in the arts. That's what I did for 4 years.
Right.
In the 80s, even though I was sort of slogging my way to finding a path, I got appointed by the governor at that point to serve on the board of the new 42nd Street, which is a not-for-profit organization headed at that time by the great Cora Khan. And the job of the new 42 was to take all those shuttered theaters that are between Broadway and 7th and 8th Avenue,
yep,
and reinvent them. Mostly everybody you know, I'm sure yourself, has been to the theater that had a lot had Lion King in it for many years. That was one of the earliest steps forward. But in the course of serving on that board, which I did for, I think, 17 years, I mean, a very long period of time, I came to understand the Times Square dynamic pretty completely. I came to understand the benefit programs. I came to understand the challenges. I also came to understand the government issues, state, city. There was no real federal presence, state and city that were involved there. And one of the advantages that I hadn't realized when I was working in government, I would say, if you've never worked in government, you don't actually understand that the drivers of decisions in government are really not at all like they are in a commercial environment, as we used to call it, a for-profit environment. I remember once saying that to somebody about working in a for-profit environment, and they looked at me and said, "What else is there?" You know, it hadn't occurred to them that there was another world where profit was not the driver. A conversation that Larry Silverstein and I have had is the reverse. If you negotiate with government entities and make money the number one matter, you've missed the whole point. And you have to figure out what their drivers are, which are not necessarily about, again, one hopes that they're being fiscally smart, but the political side of it is far more dominant in their hierarchy than the financial. Whereas if you can make a compelling financial argument, it may not always win, but it certainly puts you into serious contention for whatever it is. So the point of the story is doing a philanthropic thing, the New 42, I came to understand it. I was working with Condé Nast. I had the great benefit of, at one point in my career, I think it was the years I was at ABC, I needed to make more money. And so I did a column for Vogue magazine. So I actually knew people at Condé Nast. And I might add, I really understood the business of Condé Nast. And at that point, Cy Newhouse, the great Cy Newhouse, was leading the organization, and he was in a serious acquisition mode. So they, even though his dad, S.I. Newhouse, had bought him from Borden's Milk, 350 Madison, so that his son would have a building to put all his companies in, they had outgrown that building by quite, they were in a whole bunch of different locations.
They were spread out, I remember, right?
Yes. They were scattered around. And again, this was really the acquisition thing. And I think, I always think that probably the moment I endeared myself to Cy, not that he ever said it that way, but he asked me to meet with him and his CFO and talk about their situation. And I told him that really, if he was serious about consolidating these properties, that what needed to be done was to make all the leases coterminous to a single date. And that date, by the way, was going to be four or 5 years hence. And I think at that moment, he realized, A, that made perfect sense because they didn't want to have a tail hanging out there. And B, what I was effectively telling him was I wasn't going to make any major commission for that period. I mean, implicit, I didn't say these words because, to be honest with you, I was just thinking, what's the smart move here? And the smart move for the company was to be patient, bring everything together, and then have that planning period. That's what made it. They were the what was then called Four Times Square. It's not called that anymore. 151 West 42nd Street today. What was then called Four Times Square was the first new office construction in Manhattan in a decade. And what made it possible was that Condé had there was no tail. It was a clean deal. And when you brought everybody together and you got the efficiencies of scale, you know, you don't have all these cafeterias, reception. I mean, they were so scattered that they were duplicating all manner of things. And we had an incredibly favorable deal, and government benefits. We made a really, really successful deal for them.
So you talk about lots of interesting pieces there. I mean, one of your, as you say, coming out of Washington and getting on this 42 commission is like the early stages, perhaps, of public-private partnerships in real estate.
100%. You're so right about that. I remember that with the redevelopment of some of the other theaters, Forest City Ratner was in the throes of, I remember they picked up a theater and moved it down the street. I mean, it was an incredible feat. Bruce Ratner was heading it. I remember meeting Marianne Gilmartin at that point.
Right.
And they were all, it was really the dawn of a really rich environment for that, with a lot of very capable people on the government side, leading the way.
So you, we can talk about a lot of different things here. I don't even know where to start because there's so many good questions I'd like to ask you. So here we sit now, 5 years, right? Post-COVID, it's amazing. It's 5 years already. And New York, for sure, is in a pretty good position vis-a-vis other, I would say, tier one cities, right? Mm-hmm. You know that, you don't just sit in New York, you've got great perspective. I heard Spencer, talk last week, 2 weeks ago at the Real Estate Roundtable about how good things are in New York and, RXR is doing the conversions and all these good things happening. And I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, well, you guys are really lucky because, it's not quite that good in Washington and Chicago and San Francisco yet. We'll get there, I'm sure. But, so here we sit. You've now been part of, observed, and I'm sure done many deals where offices, users are reducing space, trying to figure out, what is the future, in the return to office. I saw, I think, yesterday it's a report that we're now at 54% from the pre-COVID number, which
nationwide,
not in New York, I'm sure. And of course, not down south. Right.
Right.
I mean, so you got a lot. I mean, we all know, right? That every market is got its own idiosyncrasies, right? But so, what are you thinking and seeing and advising clients on what their space requirements look like and feel like, and how they are going to address their space needs in the next 3 to 5 years?
I think what makes this period particularly interesting is that there's no one size fits all solution. And it's become much more bespoke than I can ever remember it. First of all, the return to work policy is different. Let me set financial services aside, okay? Because right now financial services is come back 5 days a week. I almost don't know of any bank, private equity, or a hedge fund that isn't looking and saying, I'm sorry, what are we talking about here? Okay, so again, that's a whole other conversation. But if you're looking at most other businesses, you will see a major advertising firm, a global advertising firm who's been kind of, and I won't name them because I has been all over the place since COVID, announced last week, universal 4 day, this is US, other US operator, universal 4 days a week in office and 2 Fridays a month. This from people who were like, we're never gonna have to come back to the office, shrink. And we also, of course, heard from them that they're short on space. But, the way I would tell you is it's not only customized to the individual company and its human resources policy. How are they engaging their workforce? What segments of their workforce need to be in the office, must be in the office all the time, can work remotely, et cetera, et cetera. But also the geography in which they're operating. So you can take the same company, move them to, pick a place, Texas, and you're going to have a different solution because how they're living there, how they're commuting there is very different than New York. So we have those two things. And then I think the other thing that is really fascinating is the recognition. And I don't think I've ever seen this in my career as clearly as I see people enforcing it now, that the quality of the workplace actually matters in hiring and retention. You know, we all have lived through the cube, how many square feet can we cram people into? The big decision was how high the cubicle walls should be. And again, we had a whole TV series based on movies that were made about that. The sort of, I don't know, the pedestrian nature of the work environment. I don't know a single, and I really am talking about the spectrum. I have a wonderful customer, the Hospital Workers Union, 1199, who I always like to say, I took from a hellhole and brought them to paradise, okay? And their paradise, by the way, is three Garment Center buildings that were knocked together. And through Gensler's genius, and also I shouldn't just say Gensler, the great architect David Ajay, working with Gensler, they created, with very frugal, being very frugal, the most wonderful work environment. So I visited them the other day for a variety of reasons, 5 years after they moved in. And while I was there, I said, I'd really like to walk around with you. It's a big operation, it's over 700,000 square feet, because I wanted to see what it was like. Their work policy, by the way, is every other week you can work from home, but it's strictly enforced. 5 days a week on, 5 days a week, if you will, off. And they monitor it with the swipes of people coming in, to the point where if you're found not adhering to the policy, it's grounds for dismissal, and that they've had almost perfect observance. But they also point out that for many of their workers, it's been a challenge to tell them you have to stay home. This is your week off. They don't have enough. So this is your week off. And people are like, I like to be here. You know, they have a wonderful cafeteria, they have outdoor space, they have a very highly energized and attractive environment. Where they did, Ajay did a brilliant job with images that come from the union's history, et cetera. And so there's a sense of connectivity to their mission, meaning I always say they take immigrants and make them citizens. People who work in hospital, they do a fantastic job. They train there. Again, I love this. They have a retirees lounge where on any given day, their retirees are all sitting around, coming from wherever they come from, mingling with each other. This is so far from the environment we took them from, where everybody was in cubicles, you know, looking up over the cubicle to see what person was invading their space, to a place now where they not only feel connected to their mission, but they feel connected to each other. And the people who came before them. I mean, again, I just love because they serve coffee and, you know, whatever else, little stuff to eat in the retirees lounge. And you can just see that, you know, people make appointments. Let's all go and we'll meet at the union on such and such a date. I use this as an illustration because whatever form it takes, it's different for every company now. It goes to the culture of the company and it makes it hugely fun to work on. And it makes it, the way I put it, is that our job is to translate their vision of what their optimal work environment and their optimal employee interaction and their optimal economics are. And we just take all of that and find it how it fits to a piece of real estate or two or three, depending on what it is.
One of the great comments early on in the pandemic, I heard it was an interview with Fascitelli and Roy March, right? And Roy said something like, "You can't build culture remotely.
Oh.
You've got to get your people back into the office." And that's a great story about that. You talked a bit about what we, heard lots and lots of discussion in the last few years about the flight to quality, right? I love hearing Owen Thomas always talk about how high that percentage occupants are in the Boston Properties buildings because they're all such good buildings, just like One Vandy and lots of other places. But talk about a little bit. So there's only so many, trophy buildings in all these major cities, right? And we seem to be in a period now because of interest rates and other issues, including the uncertainty, where there's not a lot of new construction. So you've got the challenge of where is it going to be enough trophy level space for those kinds of tenants? And secondarily, how in New York City, which probably has of all the major cities, the highest percentage of older buildings. I know I've read it, I can't remember what it is. And you've got some conversions and you had the tech thing that saved the, South Park Avenue or South Madison Avenue stuff. But how are those two things going to play out in the coming years?
So I feel that we're at the beginning of what will be a very difficult stage for our tenants. I'll describe that in a minute. But it's going to precede a real reinvention of the new Manhattan, let me be specific, Manhattan office environment, complete reinvention. So let me start by saying to you that in 2010, I was chairman of the Real Estate Board of New York. And I always think typically, if you're chairman of the board, which is a 3-year term, you try to leave something as a legacy. And since I was the first broker in 30 years to use as owners to be named to that, I was also the first woman, I wanted to have a legacy. So I didn't know what to do, but I was having lunch one day with a woman who then headed city planning, a woman named Amanda Burton. This is under Bloomberg. And we met at the Odeon in Tribeca, very chic. And I remember she ate a hamburger. I remember this quite distinctly because she's a tiny little person. And she ate it with a bun. I was very impressed. And she said, "What should we at city planning be thinking about?" And I said, "The rezoning of Midtown East." And she said, "Really? Why?" And I proceeded to tell her how old the Park Avenue corridor was. Now, this is 2010, okay? And my belief that if you looked at, and at this point, we were very focused on New York competitive with London, I should tell you that. Not to say it wasn't competitive with Hong Kong, it was really London. And I said, our office stock is really sort of, I feel like I'm in an old movie. You know, like when Cary Grant and Deborah Carr were into the top of the Empire State. I said, the buildings are all from the 20s or the 50s or 60s. And none of it really fits with what we need. And thus began a 5-year journey to the rezoning of Midtown East. Now, I can tell you that that the gift of that rezoning is already paying off. You know, obviously, that JPMorgan Chase has moved ahead. You know that Boston Properties has cleared its site. You know that Rudin has cleared its site at 415 Madison. You know that there's a deal in place to build a new tower at 175 Park, which is where the old Hyatt is across from One Vanderbilt. You know that four, I don't know what number they're going to use, 405-417 Park, the site is cleared and ready to go. You know 460 Park Avenue is being emptied out. You know that there are a whole collection in the Midtown East corridor of people putting demolition clauses in their leases. And what we're getting in 10 years, we're going to turn around and we will have reinvented our most valuable office stock by a mile. And I am happy to tell you that this administration under the Economic Development Corporation has put in place a few, and I think a few more to come, targeted tax programs. Let me use one example, this MCOR, which essentially freezes your taxes and if you spend X amount of capital upgrading your building. It's not tear down. So we need more trophy buildings, yes, but we also need a whopping amount of very nice, I hate to call them commodity buildings, but we need to upgrade our definition of commodity, and it can be done. And MCOR is aimed to that segment. I certainly am in the group trying to convince the city that we need a program for ground-up development for our true trophy buildings. Because if you study over the last 50 years the history of when property came to the Manhattan market, it always was attached Times Square. That redevelopment would never have happened without the Times Square tax package.
Not the tax bill. Right?
The World Trade Center would never have happened. The entire development of the West Side without the program that was put in place, the ICAP program. So anyway, I think that we are in this, what will be, until we get the product moving. However, yesterday I spoke to one of the city, at a competitor, but one of the city's most talented brokers. And he was telling me all about what he's working on, which was fabulous stuff. And I said, oh, Mark, you're doing so great, et cetera, et cetera. He says, yeah, but you and I know there's no space out there. And again, he and I both deal in scale. So I knew what he meant. If you need 250,000 or above square feet, you're plumb out of luck. At, you know, I think of all the available space, which is probably about 80 million square feet in Manhattan now, something like that. Only 18% of it is from the mid-rise up. The rest of it is the base of the building. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it tells you that all the real primo stuff is being scooped up. And then it becomes a question of significant blocks. Honestly, if you are, I would say 250 or above, you're going to have to be creative in finding those blocks between now and 2031. 2032. It's a long time.
You know, it's just, I remember hearing Sam Zell at one of our real estate conferences in Chicago years ago saying, this is a really simple business. It is supply and demand, right? And you're that description, and you talk about all these, you know, sites that are really cooking and presumably going to come out of ground. And Spencer talked about this at the roundtable last month, right? The numbers, the rent numbers that you have to project, right, to make those sites work are pretty high, even for New York, right, for starters. And that activity suggests, right, that there's great confidence that that's going to happen, as you say, because of a lack of supply and presumably continuing demand in the marketplace over the next 5 years.
So the broker I was just referring to, Mark Weiss, I shouldn't advertise a competitor, but I think he's a great broker, great guy, taught me something. I don't do much. In fact, I never do law firm work for a variety of reasons.
But, smart. You're very smart.
Right. But Mark does. And we were talking about a particular deal where the rents were every day of the week going to be north of $150 a foot. And I said to him, do you really think law firms are going to be able to pay those numbers? And he said, for those firms where the senior partners charge over $1,000 an hour, yeah, they can. And he proceeded to break down the math for me of what's happened with hourly rates at the top firms and the relative relationship of those numbers to the percentage they're spending on real estate. And I have to say, clearly that's happening in financial services as well. So I do believe, I'll tell you, if the city were smart enough to put in place the new construction tax program, which historically all of them, all of them more or less look like, cheap to start, phased into full construction over 15, 20 years, I think you would see what that, because these buildings, the new buildings, are $40 a foot in taxes. You subtract out, if you just kept the normal tax, let's say for the sake of simplicity, they're paying 20. If you're subtracting $20 a foot off the actual rent because you've got the tax program, suddenly things are a lot more affordable than if they're there. So we'll see whether the city's smart enough to do it or not. But I think there are enough smart people in the city who understand this.
And do you think in these, as you said, 50, 70, 80-year-old more buildings, that you'll see more, you mentioned demolition clauses, do you think you'll see more demolition of sites in the city in the right corridors to build these, you know, new trophy buildings, whether they're office or residential?
Yeah, I do. I think, it's an interesting, again, this is case where every building needs to be studied. So for some buildings, I can see that you take off the curtain wall. I mean, this is my colleagues and I had the pleasure of working for Rockefeller Group when 1271 Avenue of the Americas, which was Time Life building, was empty, 2 million square feet.
Right next to us. Yep.
Yes. And so what happened is, in studying it, we realized that actually the bones of the interior were pretty good, that it suffered from a curtain wall that just how the fenestration worked wasn't great, certainly wasn't environmentally wonderful, but it was hundreds of millions of dollars to replace that curtain wall. And it was a gamble, right? A gamble. And other things we had to do. I always remember the lobby was landmarked. And what we needed to do was to go to the Landmarks Commission. It's actually a beautiful lobby. Go to the Landmarks Commission and explain to them that there was two sort of shed-like structures in the lobby that were clearly later additions. And we needed a Landmarks Commission open enough to realize that this wasn't part of the original, if we were really trying to bring it back. And we did get the permission to remove it. I personally think, you know, obviously bias, but I think that lobby is one of the most beautiful in the city today. And it's where it has, if you remember, the street is the Copacabana tiles that are out there that I think are gorgeous. Anyway, I can tell you that as soon as we could demonstrate to the market, we had to actually pull the facade off a section of one floor, slap the new facade up and show and demolish, et cetera. At least that's like that. 2 million square feet. It was wonderful. It was like a heady period. You know, we started with Major League Baseball, the perfect, right?
Yeah.
No category killer. People were happy to be in the MLB build. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't like one bank said, I can't be in a bank. One law firm, I don't want to be it. It's none of that. And in any event, it's that kind of thing. When you look at the asset and you determine what here can be, the ones that cause me pause are not the 1950s and 60s, 70s buildings. The Chrysler Building. That's, if you say to me, what are the buildings I worry about? It's buildings that are landmarked, and the Chrysler is the most extreme example, where I don't know what you do.
That's why I give Tony Malkin amazing credit for what he's done at the Empire State Building.
By the way, can I tell you, you are so right to say that. I am awestruck about what they've accomplished there.
Yeah, it's amazing. So look, we've only scratched the surface here of the things I'd love to talk to you about. And I don't want to take up too much of your time. So let me ask just one last question. Your career has just spanned lots and lots of things, both Washington and New York, but focused on real estate. Tell me, what's the best business advice that you've gotten that you would like to share?
I have to call out Larry Silverstein. You know, we've worked together closely since 2005. I don't think a week has gone by from 2005 to today that I to the great Mr. Silverstein. And in many dark moments, because we had a lot of cyclical moments and other difficulties. I can think of deals we've lost, et cetera. And he always says, keep on going. Just keep on going, girl. No, you have a quality going because me, sweetheart. Keep on going. And to a certain extent, listen, all the truisms apply, right? You have to have relationships and integrity. You have to have deep knowledge of whatever it is area you claim expertise in. You have to have experience. You have to have a network of people you trust and learn from. But at the end of the day, you have to be resilient. I don't know anybody who's flourished in this business, in any facet of the business, that hasn't had to ride out something or many somethings. And how you ride that out, whatever those periods of difficulty are in whatever form they take, is the thing that separates, I won't say the men, how about I say the women from the girls? I think that that's the lesson all of us who are still at play in this world realize. You got to get up in the morning and just keep going.
Great. That's terrific and spot on. I would agree wholeheartedly. So, Marianne, thank you so much for sharing your insight and wisdom and perspective with this audience. I know both the men and the women especially will really, really appreciate what you've been able to tell us today. And maybe we'll have to do a second chapter in the future.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. Truly. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye.